The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Well, folks, again, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. We've got a good intellectual exercise for you in the time we're going to spend together. America is, as we all know, the only presidential democracy in the world in which the president is elected, if you will, via an electoral college rather than the direct election of voters or by voters. We are also the only democracy in the world with lifetime tenure for our Supreme Court justices, and our Constitution is the hardest in the world to change because it requires supermajorities, not just in one, but both legislative chambers, plus the approval of three quarters of the states. Today's guests on the Michael Steele podcast have some thoughts about how we begin to reform this system to make us less vulnerable to minority rule. I'm excited to welcome Steve Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, both professors of government at Harvard University and the co-authors of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. Tune in, join in, coming up next on the Michael Steele podcast. Bring your pad and paper and some coffee. You're going to love it. You're going to enjoy it a lot. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. It is always great to be with you, as you know. I love you guys. You guys show love on me. And, you know, I like to press the envelope and really kind of push out our thinking about things. So that requires, as we do in most gatherings, bringing really smart people to the table, you know, to help a brother out, because I don't even pretend to know half, let alone all of what's going on out there. And I think we've done that with two very, very smart gentlemen, professors of government at Harvard University, and co-authors of the book, Tyranny of the Minority. It is a real pleasure to welcome both of you, Steve and Daniel, to the conversation. So, hey, welcome, guys.
Yes, great.
Thanks for having us, Michael.
It's a real pleasure, as I said, and your book, newly released, This Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. You know, I've been saying in this sort of exposition of what's been happening since 2015, that there's a lot more historical footnotes to this, a lot more places to start before we get to what we've seen play out over the last 6 or 7 years. And this idea of this embrace of authoritarianism, authoritarian figures, this idea of embracing sort of anti-government in the name of reforming or deconstructing the administrative state. Help us sort of set the stage of your book and what you're driving at right now in trying to get the American people focus on what's happening, the way it's happened, and how we can find ourselves caught up in it in a way in which you wake up one day and it's done. It's happened. Who wants to start?
I'll start. You redirect me if you want us to go in a different direction. But very quickly, you know, we wrote How Democracies Die kind of in a hurry back in 2017, and it came out in 2018. After, with the emergence of Trump, that sort of surprised everybody in the United States. So what we did, we drew on our research on democratic breakdown in Europe, in Daniel's case, Latin America, in my case, to try to give Americans, to kind of sketch out for Americans what could happen here if we don't watch out. Because obviously most Americans weren't thinking about the collapse of democracy in 2016-17. And so we just sort of described what can happen in an effort to warn Americans. And then we got just a deluge of questions after that book came out from journalists, from citizens, from people everywhere we went, which was, you know, how the hell do we get out of this mess?
Yeah.
And so this second book, is an effort, first of all, to dive deeper into the problem. Because as you're right, Michael, this problem didn't start in 2016. It starts much earlier than that.
Yeah.
So to better understand the roots of the problem, and then to think seriously about this question of how do we get out? And that led us into some directions that we didn't expect initially to go in, having to do with our country's institutions.
Daniel, what are some of those things that you guys didn't expect in terms of what you found brewing beneath the surface in America as we're all tripping over inflation rates and who's up, who's down, the Kardashians and all the stuff that are mind-numbingly stupid at times that distract? And I was having this great conversation about that distraction with my son earlier today. What are some of the things that you found that really are problematic and that are pulsating beneath the surface here that we should be paying attention to?
Yeah, so just to reiterate something there, I mean, so really it's not, of course, just not all about Trump. The problems are deeper. You know, it's important to recognize, to try to figure out what those are, because unless we confront that, then we'll sort of be back in this moment, you know, very quickly again. Mm-hmm. So one of the big things that we, you know, I think we had some sense of, I mean, other scholars have worked on this, but we really dug a little bit deeper into was the degree to which driving this is a kind of process of a transformation of American society. As America has become more diverse, you know, in the post-1965 world of increased immigration and political rights for all Americans, the inability of the Republican Party to cope with that transformation, you know, first thriving it, I would say, through the 1980s into the 1990s, into the early 2000s, but then really beginning during the Obama era, the inability of the Republican Party to cope with that transformation. So as American society became more diverse, the Republican Party was not able to tap into that diversity to win majorities of the vote. And so this sparked two big reactions. Number one, it meant that, you know, if a party can't win elections, and this really draws on our knowledge of other cases of democracy and democratic breakdown, if a party can't win elections, you know, repeatedly, then there's a great temptation to turn to non-democratic solutions to try to hold on to power. But also a kind of at a deeper level, the reaction of many Republican voters, of course, not all Republican voters, but many Republican voters to the sense of existential threat that was perceived with this demographic transformation. So this kind of propelled the Republican Party, key elements at least of the Republican Party, into a spot that we just really would have never expected in an American, in a thriving democracy. And this really comes from, you know, looking at other cases, you know, I studied 19th century Germany and looked at conservatives, an aristocratic party that couldn't really cope with the rise of the working class. Steve studied Latin American democracies. And, you know, when you have parties that can't win and can't figure out how to turn things around, then start resorting to these other mechanisms of trying to stay in power. So that was one big part. And then I won't really get deep into this because I think we'll talk a lot more about this. But just kind of as a headline, I mean, the thing that really surprised us, because that first part of the story, in some sense, is pretty broadly known
right.
At this point. The thing that really got us motivated to write this book was this perception that our institutions, rather than making this transformation easier, in some ways is making it more difficult, because it's increasingly possible for a party to win power without winning majorities. And if you can do that, then this is actually slowing the process of transformation and adaptation. And so this is actually making the problem worse. So we could talk a lot more about that.
Oh, no, and we will, because there's some aspects of this that I really want to peel back a little bit more, particularly around the Electoral College. Some of the work that I'm doing with National Popular Vote and efforts, ranked choice voting and things like that are trying to, in some cases, work within the construct, but in other cases, redefine the construct of our electoral system. But I want to go back to something that both of you put your finger on. And I, you know, of course, I'm a very partisan guy. I was head of, you know, the Republican Party and you know, dealing with Tea Party and a whole bunch of other stuff that happened on my watch, both nationally and locally. But one of the things I've learned, gentlemen, is that a lot of this is easy to kind of put into the Republican bucket and not so much into other buckets that could exist out there as well. And so what I have found is the appeal of this sort of right-leaning thinking, the sort of Trumpian clarion call, to rise up against the man, it's something that cuts across party lines. Is that something that you've seen in your research as well? That is, yeah, it may emanate and start inside the right leaning political culture, but that it bleeds fairly freely into other areas and is warmly embraced by those that may surprise you. Because what I found in the political cycle, that there was very little that distinguished, for example, the Bernie Sanders voter and the Donald Trump voter in that election cycle. In fact, I ran into quite a few Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump voters who were very clear that if Bernie Sanders was not the nominee of the Democratic Party, they would be supporting Donald Trump. What was your experience in that regard?
Look, there is, I don't think we have our minds around exactly what's going on globally, but there is a striking level of public discontent.
Mm-hmm.
And public distrust with politicians and political institutions and governments all around the world. I see it pervasive in Latin America. Daniel's better equipped to talk about Europe, but it's pretty widespread in Europe. It's hard to find post-COVID a democracy in the world where a majority of citizens say they're satisfied with the status quo. The level of public discontent is deep. That's probably been exacerbated by social media. That's one element of the mix. I think COVID and its many consequences, the pandemic, the economic consequences, the educational consequences, the lifestyle consequences, we're still catching up to exactly the political ramifications of the COVID pandemic. So there is a lot of public discontent that politicians, sometimes left-wing, sometimes right-wing, sometimes centrist, who just say, you know, the hell with all of these guys. We're going to take a wrecking ball to the elite.
Right.
That can gain a lot of support from discontented voters across the spectrum. And that sort of populism, again, left, right, sometimes ambiguous, has had an appeal across in democracy across the world. We see it all over Latin America. So it's not too surprising that Trump's appeal casts a wide net and attracts people, I would say, more often white men from across the ideological spectrum, but people across the spectrum. And so, yeah, it's not surprising. That said, you know, Trump's vote so far, there has been some evolution. There are some tweaks, but Trump's vote so far is still not dramatically different from Romney's vote in 2012. It's still a mostly Republican vote.
Right. So to that point, Danny, you have this this sort of broad swath of ideology that forms up and people kind of move in and out of it. To Steve's point, but it does take hold. What you see it play out in places like Italy, the Brexit movement in Germany, in London, in Great Britain, for example. How do you see this environment shaping the way we narratively address this populism? Because it seems to me, in many instances, using COVID as an example, the system kind of perpetuates it. The system kind of sets up the straw dog, and it sort of creates the enemies. I mean, in not sort of dealing with the underlying essence of the pandemic, right? What did we get fixated on? Wearing a damn mask, the very thing you need to protect yourself from, the thing that's killing everybody that, you know, presumably you should be fixated on. We were distracted by other things. And I think we see examples in Europe, here in the US, where that distraction becomes so consuming that the underlying rot is ignored.
Yeah, it's pretty striking, really, that there's about 20 to 30% of citizens in West European societies and America who are very similar. You know, so that the core of the MAGA vote is not so dissimilar from the 25% or so of the vote that went for Maloney's party, mm-hmm. or that supports the AfD in Germany. It's really, you know, it's a really strike. I mean, it's kind of a sociological regularity that there's about 20 to 30% of all of these Western societies that look, that find these kinds of messages appealing. And, you know, it currently in Western Europe, it tends to be on the far right. Although, you know, but I think, you know, to Steve's point, it grows out of disaffection, broadly speaking, you know, so there's an anti-immigrant element to it. But what happens, like, you know, so the AfD to the far right party in Germany, you know, they grew to like 25% of the vote, essentially, you know, reacting to the refugee crisis. So very similar and familiar to American kind of debates. But, you know, then very quickly have now shifted to be, you know, really against climate legislation, or, you know, forcing people to have heat pumps in their homes. And they're right. You know, quite entrepreneurial.
Right.
You know, as one issue kind of dissipates, they tap into the next issue. You know, first it was COVID, now it's kind of climate change responses. And so I think what that suggests is that there is this deeper underlying satisfaction, which these parties are able to tap into and to foment and to flame, you know, to inflame the issues. And so, you know, I'm not, you know, so the question, like, again, for the sociologists or the political scientists, trying to understand what's driving this, what's really propelling
this.
Yes. That's in a sense what you're at. Asking us, and I, you know, it seems to be a mix of these factors. I mean, certainly, you know, demographic change is a big part of it, but that's not all it is. You know, it's also a kind of sense of, you know, like the gender, the kind of stuff with gender and transgender identity. This is stuff that's driving this. These, you know, these dramatic transformations.
Can I just jump on that? I mean, you put your finger on a pulse that really, I just, the transgendered people. Immigrants, Black people, brown people, white people, women, people have always been there. It's not like we just suddenly just woke up and said, oh my God, you mean there's a transgendered person in my community? Yes, because it's your nephew. It's your sister, right? So I don't understand what's driving the sudden push for otherism. The fear of others. Is it the sense that we're become so selfish and insecure all at once that we now look at others and blame them for our insecurities and our selfishness?
I mean, I think there are at least two things going on. Again, we social scientists are running after this thing, trying to figure it out real quickly
to your point. You guys are going to need a couch more than the American people will to figure this stuff out, dude. I don't envy the work you have to do to really peel back the layers of the onion and the weeping from that you're going to encounter.
So a couple of different streams, though. One, which we don't focus on too much in our book, but is clearly there is a lot of economic insecurity out there among middle classes. There are rising levels of inequality going back decades, stagnating levels of social mobility, and a lot of uncertainty and insecurity since the 2008-2009 financial crisis, both in Europe and the United States. That underlying economic anxiety is almost certainly at play. I think the other factor, and people disagree on how much this matters, I personally think it matters a lot, is two things are going on in the United States a little more rapidly than Europe, but also in Europe. We're undergoing this transition to multiracial democracy,
right?
Which means a couple of things. One, we are much more diverse than ever before. We're simply a much more diverse society than ever before. But also, we're doing a better job of protecting the rights of the so-called others than ever before. So, mm-hmm. You know, we have gradually, but importantly, advanced in the enforcement of civil rights legislation since the 1950s, 1960s, and groups that have been at the margins and maybe, you know, effectively stayed in the closet for decades and decades and decades, who of course were there, but didn't feel empowered, legally empowered, socially empowered to say, hey, I'm here. Now in the 21st century feel they have the power to say, hey, I'm here, protect me, protect my rights. And so there are more rights being demanded than there were 50 years ago, which I think is a good thing. But we have in the United States, we're going through this transition in which a overwhelmingly dominant ethnic group, and you know, in effect, to simplify, white Christian men, white Christians are losing their electoral majority, their numerical majority, but most importantly, they're losing their dominant status, their dominant position in social, economic, cultural hierarchies for the first time. And that's a really threatening thing. And I think that that is, personally, I think that that's at the core of the kind of radicalization of elements of the right across the West.
So that's why, so then you would say, and that's why you argue in the book that we see democracy so much under assault right now, more than we see, as you noted, maybe in Europe and elsewhere as a wealthy nation, intellectually on top of its game, economically powerful, politically powerful, militarily powerful, and yet just stuck on the stupid of diversity, just stuck on the idea that, oh my God, you mean there are equally wealthy and capable, competent players who don't look white, male, and Christian who can come in and be as dominating on this landscape as we have been. So the idea of actually sharing in that, where we can take, you know, a person of color who is all about the American ideal and promoting the American ideal, despite all the other ish that we have to deal with, they still come off threatened by that.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's this sense in which equalization feels like status loss, you know, and so yes, that's, you know, well, when you've been in a privileged position, then just having to compete on a fair, you know, the Harvard Library, Harvard Widener Library, which is a massive, you know, beautiful library that you can go in to do incredible work. For most of Harvard's history, women weren't allowed into the library, you know, even if you were a Radcliffe student, you had to get, you know, special permission. So, you know, think about the kind of monopoly on knowledge that, and so that's just symbolic. I mean, that's, you know, we didn't even talk about that in the book, but that just recently occurred to me. You know, that's sort of the model of which, you know, you have the kind of stratified hierarchy, equalization, the level playing field is kind of can be for some people perceived as a major threat.
So I want to shift to what I think facilitates the threat more than anything else, and emboldens it, gives it value, and gives it face, and that is political leadership. You talk about in the book this idea of or question, you know, this idea of what does it mean for, you know, a party to be committed to democracy? And I want you to address that. So what is that, a party committed to democracy? But then I have a part B to that that I think animates and drives that more than anything else. And that is the men and women who we call leaders, who we identify and define as our leaders. So let's start with the first part, addressing what you talk about in the book around, you know, exactly what does it mean to be a party committed to democracy?
So we try to offer a really simple definition here. We draw heavily on the political scientist Juan Linz, who was taught at Yale for many, many years. We argue that to call a party committed to democracy, it has to do three things. It has to always accept the results of elections, win or lose, pretty basic, kind of the cardinal rule of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, and very importantly these days, has to unambiguously renounce, eschew political violence in all forms, must be willing to denounce and break from unambiguously violence.
Mm-hmm.
And third, ultimately, most importantly, I hope this is where we focus our discussion, is that the party has to be willing to denounce and separate itself from anti-democratic extremists on its own flank.
Bingo.
Right? It's very easy for people on the left to denounce far right wingers who are, you know, they can call fascists. It's very easy for people on the right to denounce communists. But the really critical test is when an authoritarian threat emerges in your camp. And parties that are committed to democracy always expel and denounce and politically renounce elements that are threats to democracy. Parties that kind of hide under the table and maybe justify or engage in both sidesism or condone or even protect those anti-democratic extremists, they are the ones that get us into trouble.
So, Stephen, you put your finger on the exact point I want to go to next, because this is a great quote from your book, I believe it's like on page 40, 41, in which you say, quote, openly authoritarian figures like coup conspirators or armed insurrectionists are visible for all to see. By themselves, they often lack the public support or legitimacy to destroy a democracy. But when semi-loyalists tucked away in the hallways of power lend a hand, openly authoritarian forces become much more dangerous. Democracies get into trouble when mainstream parties tolerate, condone, or protect authoritarian extremists when they become authoritarian enablers. Indeed, throughout history, cooperation between authoritarians and seemingly respectable semi-loyal Democrats, small d, has been a recipe for democratic breakdown. You have, for me, when I read that passage, went, that is it. That has been my frustration inside my Republican Party, watching the likes of Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy and others enable this authority. I'm going to be a little crass, gentlemen, so forget it's not the most politically correct nor philosophically prudent thing to say, but enable
your show.
Right. Yeah, that's one way to look at it. But enable these authoritarian assholes to go out and spew their bile, their vitriol, their bullshit, feeding the masses, allowing it to happen. So you don't get to condemn insurrectionists on Wednesday after January 6th. And then 3 weeks later, go embrace the one who set up the insurrection. And that split screen, if you will, in American politics, it is what drives me so crazy right now within my own party. And, you know, folks who listen to me know why I stay, because it pisses them off, because I want to hold the mirror up every day to show just how full of crap they are. You can't get to do that. And we're watching right now, gentlemen, the self-same enabler, Kevin McCarthy, after 15 ballots of placating and BSing around to try to become speaker, now will lose his speakership by the very people, right, that he has enabled. That quote is what the end game for me is all about. So I leave it to you, gentlemen, to dissect what I just said, right or wrong. But I thought that quote was so right, spot on.
Yeah, so it's enraging. It's morally, inexcusable. But I think, for our purposes in our book, and we provide some evidence of this, it's also incredibly dangerous and reckless for democracy. It's not just a matter of, oh, we can condemn this behavior because we think it's not really a morally acceptable thing to do. It's incredibly dangerous. And there's lots of historical evidence showing that's the case. I mean, we provide the story of, we give an account of this event in France that took place February 6th, 1934, when there was an assault on the French Parliament. Militia guys in the streets with weapons, very similar to January 6th. They attacked the Parliament building, but the police beat them back. And you might think that was the end of it, but it turns out there were guys in the Parliament building, mainstream politicians in the Parliament building who were in on it. They knew what was going to happen. And rather than coming out and holding these guys to account and prosecuting them and holding an investigation of them, they excused it, they justified it. And what this did to French democracy in 1934 was it weakened the immune system of French democracy. And so by the time the Nazis invaded in 1940, you had a whole group of figures who had participated in those assaults who then were lined up in a sort of almost like a kind of fraternity organization to get these guys, recruit these guys into the new Vichy authoritarian government. So the participants in that attack, because they were not held to account, later served as, in the most atrocious kinds of positions in this Nazi supporting regime. So the point is that the mainstream politicians didn't respond.
Right.
They excused it. They out of short-term expediency. Of course, we understand, we're political scientists. We understand, careerism is a good thing. Careerism as a democracy is essential. People look out for their interests. They want to have a successful career. But when democracy is at stake, you have to draw a hard line and say this is unacceptable because you're really putting your democracy at risk. And there's a great temptation to kind of think, to come up with all sorts of rationalizations. Well, we need to be in the room because if we're not here, then you know it's going to be worse. But the thing is, you hear the same excuses over and over. Now, maybe I'll just one last line here, and then I'll let Steve, you know, say this. So, you know, Hannah Arendt.
I want to quote Michael Steele, but I'll wait.
Okay,
I'll
Hannah Arendt, the great Jewish German philosopher, looking back on at January 1933 when the Nazis came to power. I saw an interview with her recently, you know, that was recorded in the 50s, where she said the thing, you know, people misunderstand, you know, for Jewish Germans looking at what happened in January 1933, what shocked us was not what our enemies did. We knew what the Nazis were. What shocked us is what our friends did.
Yes.
You know, that's it. That captures it, you know.
Man, that sure does. Steve.
No, just to reinforce Daniel's point, again, politicians are going to do what's best for politicians so that they can get reelected and advance in their political careers. We know that. And in normal times, you know, you may not love it, but it's the way politics works in normal times. But when democracy threatens us and you and a politician is willing, because you know what they think and what they say in private, when they're willing to, you know, vote to acquit Donald Trump the second time in the U.S. Senate, or when they're willing to endorse Donald Trump's candidacy in 2024 after an effort to overturn an election, that sort of careerism is incredibly dangerous. And you said, I just want to, we interviewed you for this book. You won't remember saying this. But you said there is not a public office in the world that's remotely worth putting democracy at risk. That is an example of a what we call a loyal small d democratic attitude. That's the attitude that that Liz Cheney took, that Adam Kinzinger took, that a number of principled Republicans took. But unfortunately, you are a tiny minority of the Republican Party leadership.
And it's been frustrating as all get out, as you can well imagine. And it leads to a lot of the conversation that I think we have to have now, because the leadership is so broken. How do we engage the citizenry to sort of take up that mantle of responsibility? You guys talk about, I believe it's later in the book, in around chapter 7 or so, about you give the example of the group of 112, I think it was, Norwegian men who decided to write Constitution. It's now the world's second oldest constitution. That process of sort of taking responsibility and control of the direction of your country and what it's going to stand for. How do we capture that or recapture it? Or, you know, if we've ever really had it, have we just kind of fooled ourselves into thinking that, you know, the words on paper will just magically protect us, right? Or does it require some level of citizen action, particularly when the leadership fails so miserably in doing the very thing they should do to protect the democracy itself?
Well, I mean, our Constitution is obviously a pretty successful document, right? It's a brilliant document that has served this nation well in many respects over a very long period of time. It's the oldest living Constitution, and it is arguably the most successful. But there's one thing I think our generation has forgotten, which is ever since 1787, and in 1787, George Washington wrote a letter to a friend the year, just weeks or months after the Constitution was written, calling the Constitution an imperfect document and saying that it would be up to future generations to perfect it. And that's what Americans have done through most of our history. Sometimes it's the leaders, sometimes it's activists from below, sometimes it's a combination. But for most of our history, beginning with the Bill of Rights, just 2 years after we wrote the Constitution, through Reconstruction, the expansion of suffrage, the progressive era, the key constitutional reforms of the early 20th century. For most of our history, we've done the work of working to make our political system better, making it more democratic. And the odd thing about the last half century, about basically our lifetimes, is we've kind of stopped doing that work. We've sort of frozen the Constitution, and we've stopped talking about making the system better. And that's unfortunately allowed the United States to kind of fall behind other democracies in the world. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Daniel.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I would just say, I mean, it's easy or tempting to kind of regard what Steve just said as a kind of radical statement, you know, that you know, we have this document that's great, so why mess with it? But, you know, the thing that's based on a misunderstanding that we take a loyalty oath to the Constitution, and we need to do that, and that's wonderful. We need to defend the Constitution. But part of what makes the Constitution so great is not only what was written in 1787, but what has happened since then to the Constitution. You know, the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, you know, let alone the 13th Amendment, that, right. you know, all of these things that we value, that we defend, came about through constitutional change, not only constitutional change, but institutional reforms. And so it's, you know, there's a great American tradition of doing this. And so, you know, I think we need to realize that in fact is the kind of the patriotic and in some sense conservative thing to do, is to continue this, and that we're kind of engaged in a bit of an experiment here of what happens. Let's see what happens if we don't do this work. And I think the results are pretty clear. It's not so great.
But gentlemen, you even state in the book that America is an outlier in this regard, right? Our Constitution is the most difficult in the world to change. We have structures that are in place, for example, the permanency, if you will, of the Supreme Court, right? It's just, they're there for life. It's, all right, you get on, you're there till you die. We see now how, and I kind of refer to it this way, how the system sort of turns in on itself. Now, when we chatted in preparation for the book, we didn't get into that granular level of discussion around this idea of the system turning in on itself. But has our system, in a way, been turned in on itself as we're looking at it today? When we see now the corruption of that court, we see now the breakdown of the various institutions that are supposed to support the pillars of democracy, whether it's our justice system or our economic system or whatever it happens to be, now being used against the people, all right? Because we are a government of, by, and for the people. How would you describe that, this in particular environment that we find ourselves in relative to what we see and what you talk about happening globally, using it as you did in this particular part of the book, the Norwegian example, the European model, if you will. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, so we talk about Norway because it's the world's second oldest written constitution. So it's almost as old as the US. So it's a nice example of a country that began much less democratic than the United States at its founding, with a king and aristocratic upper chamber, but over the centuries, it's been amended hundreds of times. And again, exactly for the reason you say, it's hard to amend the U.S. Constitution. Doesn't mean it's impossible.
Right.
But over time, these institutions that we have and that other countries used to have, like an electoral college, every other country in the world got rid of its electoral college for selecting presidents. We're the only ones left with this. Every other country dealt with the same problem of courts, a little out of control. After 1945, judicial review developed in most democracies around the world, and everybody faced the same challenge of, on the one hand, we want our courts to be independent, absolutely critical to have independent judiciary, not politicized. On the other hand, we don't want a court that's so out of sync with where the people are that it's dangerous. And so the way to deal with that dilemma, other countries have said, well, you know, what we do is we have term limits. You know, this is not such a radical idea. And every other democracy in the world has this. Every other democracy has had a second chamber. Some countries got rid of their second chambers altogether. Mm-hmm. Other, you know, we don't think that should be the case in the U.S. Obviously, I mean, I think that any federal system usually requires a Senate type of body. But other countries over time made those upper chambers more proportional to population. So this also made us an outlier, and we're the third least representative upper chamber in the world after Argentina and Brazil. And then finally, just one other institution I'll mention is that it's not a constitutional institution, but rather the institution of the filibuster, which, you know, there's good arguments that we've heard, of course, for why we need to, you know, you have a filibuster in the Senate to block a potentially overreaching president. You know, imagine if Trump comes back into office and wants to abuse office. But the reality is every other democracy got rid of this kind of institution and democracy has survived. And so we are left again, once again, an outlier. So if you add up each one of these is an outlier, each one on their own wouldn't be so kind of devastating. But when you add all of them together, this leaves us in a situation where increasingly majorities you don't need majorities to win power. And this has a really distorting impact on our politics. Maybe just add one more thing on this, which is that, you know, we in a certain way, we have a kind of market analysis of democracy. I mean, the way that democracy is supposed to work is parties are supposed to compete for voters. When you lose, like a firm, what does a firm do when it loses customers? You can get a new CEO, you come up with a new strategy, you try to find new customers. That's how democracies are supposed to work. You know, think of the Democratic Party through the early 1990s, you know, lost repeatedly through the 1980s. Bill Clinton comes along, come up mm-hmm. with a new strategy, come up with new leadership, and you can regain office. The British Labour Party, similarly, you know, after many years in the wilderness under Tony Blair, revamps itself, comes up with a new ideology, new program, new proposals, new leaders. And this is how democracy is self-correcting, a little bit like a market. But we live in a situation today in a system in which, since you don't need majorities to win power, the incentives to adapt are increasingly not there, especially for the Republican Party. And so, you know, it's not the politicians aren't, you know, people talk about a cult and so on, a cult of Trump. You know, maybe for some voters, that's the case. But suggesting that it's all irrational, political leaders are doing the rational thing. Given our institutions, why try to win a popular majority to vote for the presidency? Of course, it doesn't make any sense. And so, because the Republican Party can win power without winning majorities. And so it breaks this kind of self-correcting logic of democracy. And I think it poisons the political system in result.
We're going to take a quick break. We're having a wonderful conversation with the authors of Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point, Steve Levitsky and Daniel. Daniel, I don't want to script your last name again because I did in the promos, but it's Ziblatt, right?
Ziblatt.
Ziblatt, got it. Yeah, I had to redo that promo, but Ziblatt, got it. So we're going to be right back right after this.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and Unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. Great discussion. So I'm hoping folks have been taking notes and paying attention because there will be a test on Tuesday on what we're talking about here, our democracy and the tyranny of the minority with Stephen and Daniel. I want to shift gears to talk a little bit of, because you alluded to it as we were going to break, about the systems. And one of those important cogs in the system is the electoral process, how we elect a president. Unlike all the other offices, every other office in the country, we require this sort of arcane mechanism known as the Electoral College. You refer to democracies around the globe, eliminating that from as a feature to the election of their leadership. We do not have the direct election of the president here in the United States. We elect electors who then go do the work in state capitals. Talk to us about how that distorts the process, in your view, if it does. And what are some of the remedies to address that, given that I don't know if we're going to have a constitutional convention to eliminate the Electoral College anytime soon?
Well, we don't need a constitutional convention to eliminate the Electoral College. There have been many, many, many efforts throughout American history to either reform or abolish the Electoral College. We got very close. I think Americans forget this. In 1969, the leaderships of both political parties supported a constitutional reform to abolish the Electoral College. President Nixon supported a constitutional amendment to abolish the Electoral College. All of our major interest groups, the AFL-CIO, mm-hmm. Chamber of Commerce, the American Bar Association, overwhelming majority in the House and a majority of senators all supported abolishing the Electoral College, but they didn't get the 2/3 of the votes needed to get it through the Senate, and it died. I think it's important just to, one bit of background to recall that the Electoral College is not some sort of brilliantly crafted democratic institution. When the framers were designing our republic in the hot summer of 1787, this was the first president in the history of the world, right? We were designing the first large republic in the world. Nobody knew how to select a leader outside of monarchy. Monarchy was really the only game in town across the Western world. And so these guys were in uncharted territory. There was no model to borrow from. They went through a variety of options. One option was direct election of the president. Madison was actually pretty sympathetic to that, but it didn't have support in the whole convention, in part, not entirely, but in part, because the slaveholding South feared being outvoted by Northern voters. So it was shot down. There were other alternatives.
The tyranny of the minority.
Again, yeah. So this goes way back. Madison also proposed a system that would be like contemporary parliamentary systems in Europe. That was also shot down. And the Electoral College was kind of a third best solution that was adopted because no other alternative could pass. Its designers, including Hamilton, kind of envisioned it as a body in which these sort of elites, notables, not very political, would kind of gather. They would be wise men that would kind of check the voters. It never worked that way. Never once worked that way, because the framers didn't envision political parties. The Constitution was designed before political parties were really a thing. So very quickly, parties emerged, and the Electoral College became a partisan affair as it is today. So it never worked as our framers imagined it. It was not our framers' top choice. It was a lot of improvisation, and so we shouldn't sort of reify it as some kind of a brilliant document. The problem with it, I mean, it's always less democratic to indirectly elect your leader than to directly elect your leader. So there's an argument that it's just simply a less democratic way of electing your leaders. It was very democratic for 1787. It was the most democratic system on earth in 1787, but a lot of time has passed since 1787. But the real problem comes with the Electoral College in the rare but increasingly common event that the Electoral College produces a winner who didn't actually win the popular vote. And that is simply unfair, I think, by any Democratic standpoint. There have been times in history when it's leaned unfair to Republicans. There have been times in history, like now, where it leans unfair to Democrats. But no matter what, and you know, we represent more than one party on this screen, it's unfair when the loser of an election wins the presidency. It's become a particularly acute problem. It's not an accident that it's happened twice in this century and could happen a third time in 2024. It's a product of the fact that the Electoral College is mildly biased towards sparsely populated territories.
Mm-hmm.
And that was never an issue really in the past, because through most of our history, both parties, whatever the major parties were, had urban and rural wings. Throughout the 20th century, the Democrats and Republicans had urban and rural wings. It's only in the 21st century that our parties have realigned such that the Democrats are overwhelmingly based in metropolitan areas and Republicans are overwhelmingly based in sparsely populated territories. So through no fault of their own, Republicans have an advantage in the Electoral College. And it's producing outcomes in that are not only unfair, but as Daniel pointed out, dangerous, right? If we didn't have the Electoral College, there never would have been a Trump. The Republican right. Party would have followed a very different path had Trump lost the 2016 election rather than won it.
I think that's right. How do you see it, Daniel? I think that plays out exactly right. And you know, for those of us who are working in the you know space of reforming the Electoral College process, whether it's you know with ranked choice voting or national popular vote, Final Five, et cetera, something that disrupts. And I think that disruption actually begins with the primary process. I advocated as national chairman the abolition of our primary process. If not that, then okay, let's just remake it and jumble the players so that you don't have, you know, the country start or the party starting off its electoral process by voting in from the whitest, one of the whitest states in the union and projecting that, oh, well, this is how the election is going to go. You know, it's like, well, no, because it's going to change when you go to other places. So how do you assess this Electoral College conundrum that we find ourselves in, which in many cases has contributed to the debilitation of the electoral process?
We talked a bit about how this is distorting, you know, and Steve said in 2016, you know, Trump would have lost. 2020, you know, Trump lost, but without, you know, without an Electoral College, it's hard to, of course, speculate conclusively on this, but you kind of imagine, would there be a doubling down on the Trump route to the presidency without the Electoral College? Imagine a world without the Electoral College. I think it's, you know, the world would look very different. So now how do we get out of this bind? I mean, I think you rightly point out this is the difficult hill to climb to imagine the reform, the abolishment of the Electoral College. You know, you can imagine, though, you know, let's say Texas goes Democratic, you know, would suddenly, you know, some Texas Republicans think, well, maybe this would be sort of nice to not have to have the Electoral College constraint.
Of course they would, in a heartbeat. Yeah, so this, right. I know those folks, yes.
Yeah, so this would, this, you know, so there's ways in which this could tip things. I mean, back in 1969, 70, it was a third party candidacy, George Wallace, that triggered everybody's fears. And so I think, you know, people make a short-term calculus, but there's other routes to reform. You've mentioned some, you know, there's also, you know, one other way in which this kind of imbalance could be addressed is by changing the size of the House of Representatives, because, of course, the electors are selected based on the number of senators and the number of members of the House of Representatives. You know, throughout our history, so in our last chapter of our book, we have these 15 proposals. This is one of them.
That's what I was getting to. Go for it.
Yeah. So, you know, so over the last, after every census, there's a kind of redistricting of districts and so on. And what happened up through the 1920s was that the House expanded as the population expanded. Beginning in the 1920s, when the House was expanded in the 1920s, it's never been expanded since. And so we're stuck with the number of members of the House of Representatives we have. And so as our population has grown, this means each congressional district has increased dramatically in size. So there's actually a pretty good argument for saying, well, you know, our House, you know, we can't have thousands and thousands of members of the House of Representatives, but could be a little bigger. And if it were a little bigger, congressional districts would be smaller. And this would mean that larger states, Texas, California, would have more representation in the Electoral College. So this is a way of addressing the imbalance without a constitutional amendment. You know, another idea that's out there is to say, well, you know, the winner-take-all nature, and this was something that was discussed in 1970, the winner-take-all nature of the Electoral College. Why is that necessary? You know, assign the electors based on the portion of the population that each presidential candidate gets. You know, this would also be a way of making it more representative. Overall, though, as you say, between the primary process and the Electoral College, we have a really screwed up process of selecting a president, and we're suffering the consequences. And this is our democracy. This is not from the Ark of the Covenant. This is a man-made institution that we have every right to think about, like, how do we make our lives better? And that's sort of essentially what we're arguing for.
So as I wrap up our conversation, I can really drill down with you guys so much on so many aspects of what you lay out in the book. Folks, and I cannot repeat enough how important it is to get your hands on a copy of Tyranny of the Minority, so you can begin.
Just in case you don't know what it looks like.
There you go. That's it right there. That's it. It's important so you to understand, informing your mind about the space you live in and the decisions you have to make will get not only make you a better citizen, but produce hopefully better results. So, gentlemen, how would you sort of encourage, but strongly remind Americans about the balance we find ourselves in right now? How would you ask them to assess, to encourage them to participate and become more involved in and mm-hmm. understanding the balance of things right now relative to our democracy?
Yeah, I would say that one of the great, you know, there's this notion of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that the worst kind of self-fulfilling prophecy in the world is to say, I'm not going to participate because I'm not going to have any impact. And of course, you think that, you not participate and you have no impact. And so, you know, this is our democracy, you know, every citizen's democracy, and it's in our hands. And, you know, there have been moments in our history where citizens have taken the charge very seriously. I was looking at the Progressive Party platform, Theodore Roosevelt's party platform in 1912. It's this long document with all of these ways of improving our lives. And I think, you know, it's very tempting, given the dysfunction of our institutions and the inability to address basic problems, to sort of think, well, throw our hands up and say, none of this is possible. There's nothing we can do. But, you know, that frame of mind contributes exactly to the problem. And so citizens need to be engaged, need to vote, and need to recognize that when somebody is a threat to democracy, you shouldn't vote for them. That's the sort of essence of it. Because if you vote, you know, despite what people think, politicians often do what they promise to do. And if a politician promises that he's going to lock up his opponents, if he's going to arrest, you know, to harass the media, you know what? When he's in power, he may very well do that. So, you know, take words matter, and voters have a grave responsibility.
Yeah, that's especially important when you consider when they promise to you know, build roads and bridges. That doesn't get done. But when it's going to be locking up some folks, you're pretty damn sure you can see that happen. How about you, Steve? How do you take us out of here, man?
First of all, it's important to remember that we did rise, we did respond as a society to the threat that Trump posed in 2016, 17, when he got elected. It took really almost all of us by surprise. Very, very few Americans were worried about or thought about defending the need to defend democracy. But people went out and did in a variety of different ways. Journalists, citizens, business people, a lot of politicians, election workers, state officials, local officials all across this country did stand up for democracy between 2017 and 2021 and helped us save it. Now, unfortunately, the threat is not over. It continues. Preserving democracy is hard work. So I think one really important thing is, and I'm just going to say two things. One is go out, get out of your house and join organizations. It doesn't matter that much what the organizations are. I mean, there are some organizations I would not recommend joining, but there are lots of ways to help democracy. And getting out of your house, getting offline, and actually joining organizations yeah. of human beings, working yep. with other people, does a lot of good, and it fortifies our civil society and leaves us in a better position to mobilize and defend democracy when we need it. So go out and join a cause broadly related to democracy of your choosing. If you care about voting rights, great. If you care about civil rights, great. If you care about youth participation, great. Whatever it is, go join it. The other thing, just to hopefully leave on a little bit of hope, is what keeps me going and gets me out of bed in the morning is the fact that younger generations, I think, are much, much better equipped to take our country across that line into multiracial democracy than we are and our right. older generations. The two key pillars of multiracial democracy are an acceptance of diversity and support for racial equality. And that may sound very simple, but it's only in the 21st century that majorities of Americans have really, polls show that majorities of Americans actually support both of those things. And that those majorities are far and away strongest among younger people. So our task, what I see as our task, is giving those younger generations voice, making the changes needed so that those those emerging majorities are not thwarted by relatively small partisan minorities.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, you have shared a word today, and I really appreciate the time and the effort you've put into reframing our thinking and understanding about our democracy and appreciating the moment we're in. And you do it so expertly through the book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. Really appreciate you taking that time. Folks, go out, get a copy. There it is. On the, put it up one more time, Steve. Let's hold it there for a second just so we get that shot, baby. There it is. Ah, yes, the money shot. But we really, really do appreciate it. It was a treat for me to participate a little bit that I did. But it's a more important lesson for all of us to take away from your writing. So, folks, the book, again, Tyranny of the Minority, and go out and grab yourself a copy of it. Steve, Daniel, thank you guys so much. Really appreciate you taking time here on the Michael Steele podcast.
Thanks, Michael. We're big fans of what you're doing.
I appreciate that very much. So that does it for this time together, folks. Just remember to show the love, do the download thing. Check out the book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. You can find it on all the big websites, Amazon, et cetera, to download your copy. Please read it. It's good reading. Until next time, be safe, be well out there. You can follow these gentlemen. You guys on Twitter or anything like that?
I think Dan, you are on
at DZIBLATT.
That's right.
And definitely check out Daniel there. Steve is probably the saner of the two of us. He has no Twitter account. he figured
you
out.
You can write me a letter.
Write him a letter. Spoken like a true professor. Old school. All right, folks, until next time, be safe, be well. God bless.
Facepalm America is a show for progressives and others on the left who want to keep up with the ridiculousness that this country dishes out, find out what cable news misses when they're waiting for Trump to appear at a podium, and also, every once in a while, get a laugh at how silly this hot mess of a nation of ours really is. If that's you, listen to Facepalm America. You can go to facepalmamerica.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.